Spring is in full swing, and summer is just around the corner. A great time for a beach getaway at the Oceanfront Boardwalk Plaza Hotel in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Enjoy the best of oceanfront accommodations and amazing dining right on the beach, both with great views of the ocean and boardwalk. Enjoy a soak in the heated indoor spa pool, or book the adults-only concierge level and relax in the rooftop hot tubs. Book online at BoardwalkPlaza.com or call 800-333-333 Beach. Thanks to the Boardwalk Plaza for being the Bridge Podcast Network sponsor.
Welcome to another episode of Together, part of the Bridge Podcast Network. Together, hosted by author, pastor, and communicator Jack Eason, will equip us in overcoming loneliness. We'll learn to identify what gets in the way of real community, how to develop and deepen true friendships, and discover a place of true belonging. Now, here is the host of Together, Jack Eason.
Hey guys, I am privileged today to have a very special guest with us on this podcast. We've been talking about loneliness the last several months. And Varun Soni, who is the Dean of Religious Life at the University of Southern California, is on the line. And greetings, my friend. Thanks for taking a few minutes out of your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, we are so glad that you did. And, you know, we've been talking about this issue of loneliness when I was doing a little bit of research for this book that'll come out sometime here in the future, hopefully, if I get it all done. I came across a lot of articles that you had written, one most recently, actually just a few weeks ago, in the LA Times, about what you're seeing happen there on the campus at USC, among a group that most people would not expect to be lonely, which is college students. Tell me a little bit about what you're seeing there on the campus.
Sure. Thank you. So as Dean of Religious Life at USC, I'm essentially the chaplain for the university. So over the last 11 years, I've overseen all the other chaplains on our campus, and I do a lot of work individually with students in the context of pastoral care, spiritual counseling, the sort of confidential work. And what I've noticed in that sort of context, in my conversation with students, is this change in the kinds of conversations we've been having. When I first got to the job in 2008, those were with the millennials, there was a lot, students would come to me to talk about, how do I live an extraordinary life? How do I live a life of meaning and purpose? They were filled with a sense of optimism and hope for the future, and they wanted to sort of translate their dreams into action. But over the last 5 or 6 years, I noticed a different conversation was occurring, and it in some ways aligned with the millennials leaving college and the post-millennials, the next generation, the Generation Z, sort of coming to college. And those conversations weren't about how do I live a life. They were, why should I live at all? There were conversations about meaninglessness. There were conversations about despair, anxiety, hopelessness. And what I began to realize is that what I was seeing at USC was a national trend. We know that we have a mental health crisis now for college and university students. We know that 1/3 of college and university students are wrestling with some sort of mental health challenge. More than 60% of them say they feel overwhelmed, anxious in a way that makes their work very difficult. 10% of college students are struggling with suicidal ideation. So these numbers seem to get worse every year, and the crisis seems to get bigger. What I saw in my role, sort of from a spiritual perspective, is a spiritual crisis that was underlying a lot of this, and that is this crisis of loneliness. My first 5 years in my job, I never got the question that I get almost every day now from students, and that question is, how do I make friends? So a campus of 50,000 students, and students are asking me how to make friends.
Wow.
And I think it's partly because this is the first generation that was born and raised in a social media environment. They're digital natives. They didn't migrate to a technology. They were raised with this technology. The first generation in human history to sort of communicate and think about community, which are the very essence of what it means to be human, in dramatically different ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to see that in the age of connection, a lot of people who are raised in this world actually feel disconnected. And I think there are other factors here, too. I think it's too easy to just say it's social media. There are a lot of different trends that are, I think, converging. But I do see a generation that seems to be lonelier than previous generations.
Yeah.
And what the research studies tell us now is that the loneliest generation now is not the eldest. We often think of loneliness as something that is a challenge for elderly people. We know that loneliness can have a negative physical health consequence, that if you're extremely lonely, it can be like the equivalent of smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. We know that it can be a predictor of premature death in an elderly population. But for the first time, the loneliest generation in the United States right now are the youngest, and specifically those between 18 and 22, which were essentially the ages of college students.
Yeah. And now you've been there for a little over a decade, right? So this is something
years.
you've experienced. This is not just over the last year you've seen this. This is a growing thing you've seen there on the campus there at USC.
Yeah. It's not just me. At first I thought, hey, maybe it's me. Maybe it's that I've been on campus long enough that students know where to find me, right? And students are seeing me in a different way. But when I talk to counselors and chaplains and others across the country who work at colleges and universities, they all tell me the same thing. Mm.
Now, you mentioned social media, which, a lot of the things that I've seen point to that as probably one indicator, one variable that's kind of created this issue of loneliness. What are some other things that you think? I know one of the things that I was seeing was, it talked about, and maybe this is a result of technology too, the breakdown of the family. You know, when I grew up, I remember my grandparents used to have the big wraparound porch on the house. No telephone, but they had the wraparound porch, and the neighbors would come over and congregate and sit and talk and have conversation. Nowadays, most of us, we pull into the mash the garage door button. We pull into our garage, and the garage door button, we hit it again. The door goes down, and we don't communicate even with our neighbors. Is it the breakdown of the family and the neighborhoods playing into this too?
I think that's certainly part of it. So interestingly, I spent yesterday with a professor of our school of social work who's had a 40-year private practice on the west side of Los Angeles with young adults. And he said that this generation is the loneliest, most disconnected that he's seen. He wrote a book about it called Belonging. And so I asked him, I have a 5-year-old daughter, I asked him, what should I do when I raise now that I'm raising my daughter to make sure that when she grows up, she feels pro-social, she has emotional intelligence, she has enduring and loving relationships in the real world, not just online. And he said there's the two most important factors, he said. The first, he said, is what you're saying, that there has to be significant parent time at an early age. We know that so much of our cognitive, social, emotional development happens before we're 5, and we know an investment in early sort of relationship building will pay dividends over one's life. He said even with parents who are sort of two-parent households, even affluent families, there's still not the same kind of intimate parent-to-kid time that's not sort of mediated by technology, where people are actually present with each other, that is sort of disrupting this generation. And the second thing he said is a sense of volunteerism or service orientation, there has to be a we and not a me. He thinks that in his practice, so many of his clients are just struggling with this, there's nothing beyond me. There's no, they don't believe in community or God or the government, or they have nothing to look forward to. There's no forward orientation. So having the sense of we is a powerful protective factor as well. So yeah, I think those two things are important. I also see the loss of religion as a contributing factor. Probably half of my students next year first year students will not be formally affiliated with religion, compared to 20% of the American public as a whole. So young people are increasingly disaffiliating from religion, and religion and religious community has historically been a place where people get ethical frameworks, community, relationships, a sense of belonging, a tribal identity. So I tell students, if you want to walk away from God or from your faith, that's fine, but don't walk away from meaning or purpose or ritual or gratitude or joy. Those are things that make you human.
Yes.
And I don't know if we've done a good enough job providing secular alternatives to what religion has historically done very well.
Yes.
So I think we're in a transition period, but that I think is a factor. I think that students grow up in an environment where they're active shooters on a campus almost every week, right?
Yes.
So now they view college campuses or university campuses not as these sanctuaries of learning and transformation and growth like I did, but often as places of bigotry and potentially violence. They have PTSD sometimes just by being on campus because they've spent their whole life in active shooter drills,
right?
In a way that we haven't. So that's an affiliation that they have that we don't. So I think there's like a convergence of factors. Plus, these were kids who saw their parents lose half of their wealth during the 2008 financial crisis. So they are distrustful, not just of religious institutions, but political and financial institutions as well. And so, you know, there's been a complete breakdown of trust in those less space to think about community and meaning making, right? And at the same time, they're at a university now that costs $75,000 a year. So then they're really stressed about making sure they study the right thing to get the right job, to pay down the debt. You know, I could study religion and not worry about it, but our students at this price point don't feel like they have that luxury.
You love the people in your life, but sometimes you just don't understand each other. Wouldn't it be great if there was a tool to help you do that?
The Enneagram is a great tool to inspire better connections with others, ourselves, and God. It's about learning what motivates us or how we and others see the world. Hi, I'm Ben.
And I'm Kim. Join us on the journey to better relationships utilizing the Enneagram.
Check out our podcast, If You Really Knew Me, and subscribe today.
You know, it's
so
interesting.
There's a lot of factors. There are unique.
There are, but you're hitting on so many of the things I've thought about. So it's encouraging, especially what you just said about trust. You know, I was reading an article the other week, and this will be part of the book that comes out about the guys that co-founded Airbnb, which is now, you know, the largest hospitality entity on the planet. And for people to stay in other people's homes, you know, if when they first went online with this whole idea, you know, kind of like Uber and Amazon and all these things that we now just do it every day and don't even think about. And they talked about this huge hurdle of trust that they had to overcome. And one of the things I thought was very interesting, they said they didn't want to build a marketplace that was built on money. To do that would just have been it would have been transactional, which would have been about the money. But what they said they want to do was make it interaction, which was about relationship. And so I thought, you know, that is so important, the whole trust thing, because I think that does plays into what you just mentioned about religion. It plays into our view on politics, on our country, on our campus, on friendships, a place to belong. Can I trust this friend with sharing my, you know, personal things that are a part of who I am? It's hard to have friendships without and build relationships without trust. So that is so. You know, you guys are doing something on campus. I think, if I remember correctly, reading this with like a training app that you.
Yeah,
that
so
you're,
we,
that you're
we have
using.
A we have a lot. What a lot of universities have started to do in order to sort of address the mental health challenges on campus is. Create these mindfulness programs, essentially. So mindfulness meditation, when I was in college, was very much a Buddhist spiritual practice. Now there's been enough research, data, evidence that it's become a secular sort of scientific intervention for issues that impact our community. So we have a pretty significant mindfulness program. We present it as a secular sort of opportunity to develop certain practices that can help you with, you know, insomnia or workplace happiness or, you know, substance recovery, et cetera, or just anxiety and stress, which, you know, everyone on a university campus struggles with in some way or another. So we have an app. The app is really popular, but even more so are the classes. And the classes in some ways give our community the permission to turn off their phones for an hour and just sit with each other and just sort of be contemplative and to enjoy the stillness, right? And so I've been surprised how quickly this initiative has picked up. We've only been running it for 4 or 5 years, and we're training 7,000 people a year in mindfulness practices now.
And you guys, now was this under your direction or leadership? Okay.
Yeah. So when I was in college, I spent some time living in a Buddhist monastery in India, and I met the Dalai Lama during that time, and I sort of became a follower of holiness, the Dalai Lama, and that fundamentally shaped the trajectory of my life. And so when I was thinking about what can I do to help my college students, I began to realize, hey, what I did was I meditated because I had this experience in the monastery. And now, 20 years later, I don't have to roll it out as something that's spiritual, but I can roll it out as something that's helpful for everyone. And so I really was able to draw upon my own experiences and sort of met the right people on campus who also shared those interests and values. And we just kind of built it on faith. And what was so interesting was that we didn't have to prove it. We just had to offer it. And even when we offered it, we couldn't keep up with the demand. because American consciousness over the last 20 years has evolved significantly in terms of yoga and meditation and other kinds of things that might have been considered, you know, culty 20 or 30 years ago. Now it's become so mainstream that we don't get any pushback on mindfulness. All we get is, why aren't you doing more?
Right. And this was, I guess, alongside your idea and backing here. I think I read where you guys called this person that kind of heads this up or helps with it, the director of belonging.
Yeah. So we have
cool. Very cool.
Yeah. We just decided to sort of name it, right? What we think is part of this loneliness epidemic is this underlying belief students have that they don't belong, that everyone belongs but them, that they see everyone's curated, idealized life on Instagram and they compare it to their real life, that everyone deserves to be here but them, that they're an imposter in some way. And sort of underlying that is a lack of belonging or a tribe or a group or a community. They feel like everyone belongs except them, but everyone feels that way. And so we brought in someone who we're piloting it now. The idea is that we have now a director of belonging, and she teaches classes on friendship building, on sort of interpersonal relationship, sort of engagement and meaning making. She's running a student group that's also focused on the idea of loneliness on campus. And so students are taking leadership roles. It's interesting. When she did the group on friendship, I thought it would be a lot of students who felt lonely. There were those students, but there were also students who wanted to be leaders for other students, students who wanted to be connectors, students who were very proactive. So I think even though this generation is struggling with these challenges, they're self-aware to sort of address those challenges too. They're part of the solution, not, you know.
Well, it's a great, you know, a great idea, and you are kind of leading the way there with some of the things that you're doing. I know also I was doing some reading that I guess it's been a little over a year ago now that Prime Minister Theresa May, you know, created the country's first minister for loneliness, you know, that they're calling it there in the UK. So, you know, there's obviously a need. This is not even limited to the United States. It's not limited to an age group or a specific geographical place on the planet. It's seemingly worldwide that it's affecting people with this issue of loneliness. So thank you for what you're doing to help make a difference there
on the campus.
Thanks,
Jack. Appreciate it.
We've been talking to Dean Varun Soni, who is the Dean of Religious Life. And, man, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks,
and for sharing some of your knowledge with us.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Together on the Bridge Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss a beat. Share your thoughts and questions about this episode by emailing podcast@wearethebridge.org. You can find other great podcasts by heading over to the Listen tab at wearethebridge.org/podcast.